You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm going to be talking to Paul Sinha. We're going to be finding out how anyone can be a political comic, but also it's important to stick to what you know. Without any further ado, I hope you enjoy Mr. Paul Sinha. We are sat in Paul's car.
It's a Mazda 3, if anyone's wondering.
It is.
I don't know not more about it than that. There are spaces for 6 CDs in the CD player.
Yeah.
It picks up most radio channels, but I'm not really a car person.
I'm not either. I wouldn't have been able to tell. Even looking at the logo on the steering wheel, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that this was a Mazda particularly.
No, I change my car every 2 or 3 years, although it's become... I don't drive as much as I used to.
Okay. We were saying before, the reason we're having this chat in your car is this is where you do most of your writing. And you were just saying that that's true in a stand-up sort of a way, but when you write for radio, when you're writing topical jokes for the Now Show or similar,
I tend to be at the desk.
Sure.
Anything that's much more scripted,
okay.
I tend to be in my flat on my computer.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about stand-up to begin with, and then let's talk about stand-up to begin with. What I'm trying to do as I go along is not stop, not make any asides that I then have to painstakingly edit out as I go. I'm just kind of wrestling with the thing. So, by way of introduction, you and I have gigged together several times. The last time you drove me to Southampton in this very car.
Was that the last time we gigged?
I think that was the last time we gigged together, yeah.
Okay, cool.
But we've gigged together all over the place, and I supported you on tour a few years ago as well.
You did in 2008. I believe I first met you, oddly enough, in Southampton, at Southampton Uni, in a gig for Christian Knowles.
Is that where we first met?
Where you were either support... No, you were support, and I was closing.
Okay.
I think...
Okay, I can't. I'm terrible with the. Well, you are one of the probably the most prodigiously. You even will know the word for having the capacity of memory. I was going to say memorable. You are memorable, but I meant you've got an incredible memory, which I do have
a memory for gigs and where I first met. I'm very much aware of where I first became aware of people, first met people, because you did your stuff about not being on the bus but taking it home.
Hey man,
on occasion.
It's a memorable joke. It's one of the only one-liners I've ever written.
I remember grilling you on the veracity of that comment at the first interview, because I found the concert quite exciting. So I do remember. That's literally all I remember about the gig, is that's where I met you. I don't even remember how I did.
Christian's one with the sort of, it's in a corner with a glass.
That's it, yeah.
Windows either side, yeah.
Yeah,
so we've gigged together several times, and you are someone who I think of as being... I never know how much the listener is going to know about whether they're going to come to this as a fan of Paul Sinha, or they're going to be a fan of my show and simply go, yeah, I'll listen to whoever Stu's talking to. For those people that don't know who you are, I've always thought of you as one of the very, very few comics who can genuinely make political comedy. Whereby, I'm not saying that all of your stuff is necessarily political.
Indeed, you should see me on a Friday and Saturday night.
But I do think there is a very, very small number of comics in the UK who can make a political point funny. As there's a lot of people, well, not a huge number of people, there are more people who can talk about politics and then do a joke. But you're someone who can make political things funny.
I think the key is to stick to what you know.
Okay.
Don't get in out of your depth. Try and pick topics that you feel genuinely passionate about. and try and pick topics that you actually know about.
Okay.
I mean, it's all very well calling someone a political comic, but if you tried to get me to write material about the Lord's Resistance Army of child soldiers in Uganda, mm-hmm. you'd probably find that I'd come a cropper very quickly.
Okay.
But the nice thing about stand-up is that you get to choose what you want to talk about. So you try and go for topics that you feel you can bring a different angle to, or a funny angle, and you get to choose. So anybody, in a sense, can be a political comic. I think a lot of people just choose not to. Mm. I mean, it's almost impossible, I think, for, regardless of who you are or what you do for a living, to not find a topic out there that does interest you. And I always consider myself more a socio-political comic than a political comic, in that I talk about things like racism, homophobia, rather than Nick Clegg and David Cameron. I think sure. I think politics is so corrupt and left everybody so jaded that actually having a go at individual politicians is a bit dull, because anybody can do that. Anybody can hear that just sitting in a pub chewing the fat with their mates.
Sure.
I've never really taken a party political line.
No. In terms of you saying, though, that you write what you know about, I think it's fair to say that you are a pretty voracious consumer of media, and you're very well genned up on... I mean, you know about a lot of things. Casually refer to...
Yeah, I think that's fair, but at the same time, there are certain things I'm not good at all. I'm not good at stuff to do with economics. I don't really understand the recession and how we get out of the recession. I know how it affects, I know how it affects us as human beings.
Sure.
But, for instance, I've never had much... instinct for writing jokes about economics or money.
That's interesting, because I think one of the... I mean, I write the socio without any of the political. I write about my own experiences and the things that I think and feel and, you know, have touched. One of the blocks to me writing more political stuff has always been that I feel like... or I end up going down this path of feeling like I have to come up with a solution. Do you know what I mean? If there's a political problem, and I feel like, I can't really write anything about this because I either don't have a clear enough evidence-based standpoint,
sure,
or I don't have something better to offer in its place.
Yes, exactly. I remember doing a corporate gig last year where the guy... I didn't know the nature of the gig at all, which is more fool me. I think if you are going to take corporate work, you should be a little bit more savvy about what you're doing. And the guy before me was this right-wing conservative MEP called Roger Helmer, who gave a speech for 20 minutes on how climate change was a myth.
Oh, my God.
And what really frustrated me at the time was thinking... I don't know how to rebut this guy. I don't have the knowledge or the research or anything like that to know how I rebut his ideas.
Because even though he's definitely wrong, he's going to beat you in an argument.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I'm thinking of people like Mark. That's why I admire people like Marcus Brigstocke, who go on Question Time but do actually know what they're talking about. Mm. No wonder she's looking confused. We must be wondering what on earth. That's my neighbour. unpacking her car boot.
I should stress, for the benefit of the listener, we are not driving around in Paul's car. We're sitting outside his flat watching his neighbour enter her house.
in what's known as a carport. That's what the estate agents call this.
It feels actually increasingly like a stakeout. It's a shame we're not facing
it. Definitely a car. There you go. There's the engine. For anyone who's in doubt as to where we are,
oh yeah,
it is definitely my car.
And I certainly wouldn't be able to afford that sort of special effect. So here we are with Paul. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. As we mentioned, Paul is in his car. There are some fairly spectacular revelations to come about exactly why I'm meeting him and interviewing him in his car. And we're going to be talking throughout the show about how when Paul realised he was coasting as a comedian and decided to make a change in his practice and in his writing. We're also going to be mentioning when things go wrong in your real life and how that can be quite fecund for your work. And we're also going to talk about something Paul is very, very keen on, which I think is which really permeates everything he does and is something to which I would definitely aspire, is that you should be trying to do stuff that no one else could do. So only a couple of tiddly bits of admin. Right, this week it's a Facebook push. Do me a favour, if you're on Facebook, can you please share this episode or share the website on your own page or the pages of anyone you know? In fact, if all of you, because I think I'm talking pretty much exclusively to comedians still. Hello, all you comedians.
If you could share this on the Facebook page of one person each that you know who is not a comedian and see if they like it, that would be a good little thing. That's all the badgering I'm going to do this week about promotion. I've got a small core audience, but it could always be bigger. So there's that. And the second and final thing is there is an open spot or new act special coming up. So if there are any newer comics you'd particularly like to hear about, if you're a newer comic and you think you've got strong opinions, things to say about the state of the industry, then get in touch with me. It's info@comedianscomedian.com. I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to do it. I might talk to two or three people separately or together. Haven't really worked it out yet, but I think it would be interesting. I think a lot of newer acts listen to the show, and a couple of people have said to me at gigs, it's all very well, these comedians who've been going 15 or 20 years saying, then I turn pro, but how do you actually do it? My answer to you would be, as I'm sure my answer to them was at the time, you're probably not going to like the answer, which is start 15 years ago when it appears to have been much, much easier and there was far less. I don't know about much easier. It's all in context, isn't it? But good God, there was a lot less competition back then, as I understand. But we will discuss that. Let's talk about it. So if you'd like to come on the show and talk about it, please get in touch. I can't promise that I can say yes to everyone that gets in touch, but please do. And you might want to say what it is that you're going to say, and maybe I'll try and pick some people with contrasting views. It's good, this not having a producer, isn't it? It means you can just do it all yourself and explain your plans live as you're making them. So that's that. So info@comedianscomedian.com. Any advice, any feedback on the show, please keep sending in your suggestions. Now back to Paul Sinha.
So I think that's one of the things about political stand-up is make sure you choose your subjects carefully so you don't sound like an idiot. The second thing is you don't have to be political and funny at the same time. And I think there are a lot of comedians out there that are very good at deftly creating the illusion that they're a political comic. But what they're actually doing is making a political point and then another point, and it's the second point that's actually where the big laughs come in.
Yes, I certainly recognise that system of...
And that's, as far as I'm concerned, perfectly valid, because you're drawing people... I think, for instance, Steve Hughes, the Australian comic, is very, very good at that. He'll draw people in with some relatively straightforward jokes, then say something very controversial that isn't necessarily funny, and then draw them back in by being funny after that. And so there are different ways. I mean, I think the ultimate skill, of course, is to be very, very political and funny at the same time. And as you say, not many people can do that. And there are certain people I very much admire, such as Hal Cruttendon, Ian Stone, Alistair Barry, as people who can not only do it, but can do it on a Friday and Saturday night.
Yeah.
Which I think is perhaps the ultimate skill, is to be playing the hens and stagnising and getting away.
No, that is something you do, though, don't you? I mean, I've gigged you several times on Friday and Saturday nights when you've been... It's not like you completely revert to a...
No, it's not, but you do draw them in with easier stuff, I think it's fair to say. And also, you do sort of tone it down a bit so that it doesn't feel too much like a worthy lecture.
Yeah.
Because after all, on a Friday and Saturday night, in most gigs, they are out to enjoy themselves.
Sure.
And also, I don't necessarily value my opinions enough to think that people should necessarily listen to them.
Okay.
I mean, at the end of the day...
That can't be true.
No, it is true. If I'm not making people laugh, then I've failed in my primary concern.
Okay.
If I'm not making people laugh, but I am making them think, I've failed.
Okay.
As far as I'm concerned. So it just so happens, I haven't made a massive decision, oh, I must be a political comic. It just so happens that a lot of the best jokes that I've written happen to be political.
That does seem like a more organic way of becoming a political comic than by starting from the soapbox and thinking, if I want people to listen to my points, I'd better come up with some jokes. You're coming at it from an entirely opposite angle to that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually can remember... Well, the two things, actually, two things happened. Number one, when I came out to my dad, it made me think a lot about doing a political Edinburgh show, about how shocked I was at the positive reaction that I got from him. And secondly, I remember expressing some opinions about that juicy comedy topic, murder, to a friend of mine, and the friend of mine saying that he thought that if I turned that into comedy, it would make great comedy. And it just so happened this friend of mine I really fancied, and I wanted to impress him, so I decided to try and do what he said,
okay,
and make it into comedy. So sometimes great things can happen for very salacious reasons. But it was, I think you know, because I knew you then back in 2006. It was around about 2005, 2006, when I very much changed the direction I was going in my comedy.
And that was a conscious decision to...
Well, it was all about Edinburgh. I knew that I wanted to do Edinburgh, and I knew that I wanted to do a socio-political show in Edinburgh, something that wasn't slapstick or cheap. I knew that I wanted to do something that really tried to talk about some big issues.
Mm-hmm.
After that, since 2006, I think it's fair to say that my Edinburgh shows have had some politics in them.
Yes.
Even the 2010 one about the meeting with the BNP, there was still plenty of non-politics in there.
Sure.
And also, I think almost by definition, comedians have to take a simplistic view of politics. Otherwise, you don't want to lose...
Mm.
You don't want to lose... the audience's attention.
That's it. I mean, maybe in that example of you not knowing how to argue with the climate change denial guy, if you had done your... I think you need to have done your research. You need to know what you're talking about.
Sure.
So that you can take a simplistic view.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I can't take a simplistic view of climate change other than it seems obvious to me on the basis of everything I've heard and the fact that I also disagree with everything that a climate change denier would say about anything else. Do you know what I mean? It's so easy to kind of paint them as separate things. But again, I wouldn't have that all-encompassing knowledge from which to...
And that's why I think sometimes... I mean, I've got fairly well-known routines now about meeting an Islamic extremist, meeting, being on the radio with the deputy leader of the British National Party, meeting Jim Davison.
Mm.
And I think the advantage that all those routines have is there's a very clear idea of the notions of good and bad. The good guy and the bad guy.
Mm.
It's quite clear for the audience to understand where it's being positioned. Anything too much more complicated than that. And again, you do run the risk of an audience thinking that you're lecturing to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen people on stage at clubs directly slag off the Tory party or David Cameron. And I always think, well, statistically, one in three of this audience actually are proud to vote Tory.
Mm-hmm.
What do they think about this material?
Sure.
For instance. And that's why I don't tend to go... I tend to go for issues rather than telling people who they should be voted for or who they shouldn't be voted for. I think that's what I'm good at, is picking issues that I can make easy.
So did you... That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, I'm really good at everything I do because I only do the things I'm good at. Yeah.
Well, that's what... who can be good at everything?
Yeah, of course.
When I turn out to The Cutting Edge, because I do The Cutting Edge, which is the topical comedy show on a Tuesday night at the Comedy Store, and people say what they've got material on, and I always say, as usual, don't look to me for anything on the economy, recession, inflation, the banking crisis. Mm. I find it a complete comedy dead end.
So pre-cutting, so I've never...
I'm more of a people person than a money person.
Mm-hmm. So having never done The Cutting Edge, is that how it works? You get there and kind of divvy up?
Well, there's a topic. What happens at the end of the first half is the audience shout out topics for the second half. And the person who's organising that round that will then dish out those subjects at his behest to comedians.
Okay.
So if someone says that they've got a really good routine on John Terry and somebody shouts out John Terry, then lo and behold, they'll be
called Bagsy.
They'll be called Bagsy. That's what I mean. And they know that my strengths are sport, pop culture, and then religion, racism, homophobia, extremism, the nuts and bolts of the stuff that people are discussing in the pub all the nuts and bolts are the sort of thing that people are discussing in the pub all the time. And people who are in the pub are not discussing the fate of the NHS or or pension plans or this and the other. I don't know, the things that get people like, upset in a pub is the sort of stuff I'm very good at, I think.
That's a really good, starting point to kind of make it manageable from a writer's point of view. This chimes with something that Dan Evans said about writing topical jokes. There's no point looking to headlines in The Guardian and in the Independent for starting points for topical jokes because they're too complicated a subject. You mean you're taking too balanced or maybe not balanced, but too kind of huge a view to make a short joke out of it. You want to be looking at red tops and going, there we go, that's the nugget of information from which we can jump on.
You only need to look at Twitter, I think.
Yeah.
Where people write great jokes if somebody is famous has done something really stupid or said something really stupid, and don't write great jokes necessarily if people are in Parliament debating the future of the NHS.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some things just lend themselves better.
Mm.
I mean, I'm considered to be somebody. I mean, Twitter is a perfect example of where you simply pick and choose your moment.
Mm.
I got a lot of retweets last week for a joke that for me had everything that a Paul Sinhar joke should have. The Archbishop of Canterbury had resigned.
Yes,
and
okay.
And I'd written that Graham Norton's going to host a show to find the next one called How Do You Solve a Problem Like Sharia? Now, for me, that had...
That's everything.
That had religion, extremism and a pun.
Yeah.
And in essence, that had everything that a joke that I write often.
Yes, that's a distillation of cinema, isn't it? Yeah.
So I was really, really pleased with that. But you pick your moment.
Mm.
In 3 or 4 days before that, I hadn't written a single topical joke to put on Twitter because nothing had really caught my eye. And I think, I mean, obviously, there's sometimes your job means you can't just pick your topic. If you're going to be on the news quiz, for instance, where you know there's going to be 12 different topics that are going to be discussed, you have to have a joke for each of those topics. If you're going to be on Have I Got News For You or something like that, then you have to expand your repertoire.
Yeah.
But as a stand-up, you always choose. No one ever says to Tim Vine, well, these puns are all very well, but what do you think of the new plans for secondary education? Sure. Comedian chooses his persona. Yeah. And how he's perceived by the public, or what they expect.
Well, let's talk about that then, and about this moment in 2006 when you made an effort to change. Well, what was it that you were doing before? Because I'm not familiar with your act from that time. But what was lacking?
Coasting. I was coasting because mainly actually because I was still a full-time GP. I was doing comedy just because I quite enjoyed it. I had no fixed idea of a career plan. I had no idea necessarily where I was going. What I did know is that I was doing gigs and people were laughing at me and everything, and that's it. I seemed to be
doing... And all was right with the world.
Yeah, and everything seemed to be all right. But I was also aware that for about 3 or 4 years, my set hadn't really changed much either. And that's kind of what I mean by coasting. In July 2005, I came out to my dad, and a month later... I went to see Daniel Kitson. I went up to the Edinburgh Festival for 3 days, and I went to see Daniel Kitson doing his late one-man show at The Stand. And me and a couple of mates, one of whom actually was Dan Nightingale, the comedian, we sat there rather open-mouthed at just how beautiful, how lyrical, how meaningful, how utterly brilliant stand-up comedy could be.
Mm.
And I think the combination of those two things was a turning point, where I was watching Daniel Kitson going, I don't think I could ever be that good, but would it be nice to aspire?
Yeah, that's a really good approach to what we could almost call the problem of Kitson to all other comics, which is the moment when you see what he does and you come out simultaneously elated and full of possibility and depressed and full of self-loathing. you can't get to that thing.
I didn't have the self-loathing thing, other than I thought, what have I been doing for the last 3 or 4 years? Because I'm good with language. I can write a night. What Daniel's so good at is optimising his use of language to wring out the most from a joke. And I thought, well, I could do that, can't I? And then I thought, well, maybe Daniel's, you know, genius comedic skills are not necessarily something you should expect to achieve. But as I said, it was a question of raising the bar and aspiring to be something better than I was. And I think me coming out to my dad was the perfect opportunity. And it also coincided with me doing a lot of gigs up north, in the north of England, Manchester, Yorkshire, Toby Jones gigs, Excess Malarkey, that. And it was nice, I think, to get out of my comfort zone and do gigs for a wide variety of audiences as well. Because a lot of London comics don't travel much outside of London, or if they do, it's to genres this or to genres that. And it's nice, and it kind of coincided with me doing a lot of what I'd call really great, well-run clubs all over the country, where people would sit and have the patience to listen to you and indulge you in what you're trying to say. In January 2006, I did a gig in Bracknell, a gig I'm sure you know.
The Comedy Cellar.
The Comedy Cellar, which I think is my favourite gig in the country.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly one of the three or four rooms I think of when I think my favourite gig in the country.
Yes, absolutely.
Also a top group.
And that was when it was in a January, and I'll never forget the gig, because it was when I first unveiled my murder material that I'd been working on to impress the guy that I fancied.
Was this your material about... in order to be on the front cover of a newspaper?
So I first unveiled my murder material.
Can we just ref what that is for the sake of
it's, it's something
it?
That I still believe with a passion, but it seems to get a little bit lost, is that I believe that murder is murder. We shouldn't fetishise the murder cases based on what demographic the murder victim fits into. And it was a thing about how beautiful white girls go to the top of the list, and how black guys make the list if they're promising students.
Only if they're aspirational.
Promising students or promising footballers.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly controversial viewpoint, and one that I found it difficult to. It's become quite a topical viewpoint with the resurfacing of the Stephen Lawrence stuff in the last 6 months and all that, where I feel that I'm desperately happy for his parents that they had some measure of success. At the same time, wouldn't it be great if all the other murder victims got this level of attention as well? And it is, something I believe. But more to the point, I wrote some really good jokes to go with it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, this has got no chance.
Otherwise, it's just a good idea.
It's got no chance to survive. And I remember unveiling it. I remember doing this 5-minute material about death. Murder, and it got nothing. But as soon as I stopped doing it, the audience started laughing again. So at least
I thought you were going to say that you even when you switched material back, they hated it because the opposite.
They were back laughing. So I thought, if that was the only bit they hated and they still liked me, it probably was no good. But then it's important to give something at least two or three goes. And I think that's something that I've been guilty of too much in the early part of my career, is giving up on material if it didn't work the first time or the second time.
Because it's very difficult, isn't it, when you're excited about something.
Yes.
And the very first or second time you do it, you're thinking, here's my precious thing that's just made me run around my room laughing and going, I've nailed it. Maybe not. Analogy's less accurate in this case. Certainly I can appreciate that. You do it once, they don't like it, and the temptation is to go, I was wrong.
And then a month later, I had walkouts while doing this material at Chertsey Comedy Club. In fact, the gig just went ballistic. That's how bad it went. It's just people were walking out. And then 6 months later, the same material was the stuff that got me the Edinburgh nomination. Several journalists mentioning this particular bit of material as being the highlight of the show for them.
And why do you think the walkouts were? Was that people angry that they recognised an uncomfortable truth?
I think...
Or were they also going, this is so not funny?
It was a bit of both, I think. Yeah. It could well have been, this is so not funny. But I think I was very guilty of misjudging the crowd, the one with the walkouts. Because the previous time I'd played there, I'd got an encore, and so I was playing the club rather than the crowd, because I hadn't recognised that the people that were in were just not the same people who were in there the last time.
Yeah.
And I think that I know it's really, really hard, but as a professional comedian, you've got to play to the crowd as much as possible. Yeah. There are a lot of purists that go, no, you bring them into your world, you must bring them into your world. Sometimes it's just not possible. Sometimes you've just got to do the job of being the best comedian you can be at that point.
And yet, at the same time, you're saying, you were talking about Hal and Al Barry, Hal Cruttendon, Al Barry and Ian Stone, as people who who, I don't know how you'd put it, that they do stuff that it's not so much about inviting someone into their world or not, it's more that they press on with taking stuff that might not be palatable. They make the unpalatable palatable for a Friday or Saturday night.
Yes,
audience.
Absolutely. And if someone said to me, which current club comedians do you admire, they would be three towards the top of my list, definitely. Hal Crutton and Ian Stone and Alistair Barry are working at the very top of club comedy, and at the same time constantly talking about the outside world and not just them, talking about bigger issues. I saw Hal do an amazing set, actually, not in a club, but at a benefit gig for the Labour Party lesbian and gay campaign, where I'd kind of written off the audience as obnoxious and really not my people at all. I mean, Pete Waterman sat on the front table and he ignored everything I said for my entire set and just carried on chatting to someone. The temptation to just lose it and go, look, you may have written Hazel Dean's biggest hits, but that doesn't mean you can just ignore me here. But he was masterful at doing proper, all right, middle class, but genuinely very political comedy. That wasn't preachy and wasn't... Actually, this comes to the next point. It should be from your personal perspective. Anyone could be a political comic, but just political comedy like anything, you've got to aspire to be the comic that only you can be. Anyone can write jokes about Barack Obama, this, that, or the other, but write jokes because it's you.
Yeah.
Because it's important to you to write those jokes, and it fits in with your persona and what you're trying to say. Don't just write cold... Don't be a cold, calculated joke machine. That's not what you are on stage. You're Stuart Goldsmith or you're Paul Sinner. This is a product. And I think even if the product is quite a niche product, that product should be unique to you.
Yeah.
I don't think people, when they come and see me at Edinburgh, are going, oh, let's go and see Paul Sinner. He's going to have a witty take on the state of the world.
No.
I think they're going, let's come and see Paul Sinhar, because we like him and we like his outlook and we like his point of view.
Sure. I'd come and see you expecting to see more kind of stuff like the murder material, that makes me go, God, this has been going on under my nose the whole time.
Yeah.
But I'm also laughing at it, and it's also packaged in such a way that I can repeat the salient points of it to my friends. Not on stage, you know, but to my friends and go, have you ever thought about this? It's kind of, as you say, it comes from the sort of pub chat that people have.
Yeah,
and it goes
yeah.
back into it. It informs it and it becomes something people could refer to.
Perhaps that's why it gets more and more difficult to write. Write fresh stuff, the more successful you become, is you're not having as many pub chats as you used to. The very nature of success or indeed hard work as a comedian is that you're not entering those arenas where viewpoints are expressed and viewpoints are shared and issues a bit, you know.
Yeah, you like the band The Streets.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That third album, which was about trashing hotels, was really not as good. Was really not as good as the first two. I think that's a very salient point. I think that to be fresh as a comic, you do need to, you know. It's hard if you're not using public transport from time to time, going to the bank, doing this, going to the pub, going to restaurants, this, doing those things that everyone
all
is.
On one day a week. Yeah, this is research day.
Yeah, yeah. But all those things that the rest of the world are doing.
Yeah.
It's important that you don't lose touch of that, I think. I think otherwise it becomes... the cliche of the guy who does stuff about airline food and the price of drinks in a hotel minibar.
Yeah.
And this, that, and the other.
Yeah, I always remember.
And real life, in inverted commas, is much, much more interesting than that.
Yeah. I always remember in my first couple of years as a comic noticing which comics did stories about driving and motorway services and which comics did stories about trains. And yeah, well, there we go. We've established whether or not you have a driving licence.
Yeah, and then there's the next level, which is Dubai.
Yeah. So I was doing some gigs in Dubai. Yeah.
Or Mumbai. Mumbai is already, within 18 months of the Comedy Store Mumbai opening. I feel that Mumbai has already become a club comedy cliche. At a certain level of club comedy, as people got a story about a funny thing that happened to them on the streets of Mumbai.
Yeah,
but I don't.
I mean, it's got to be one of the. What do I mean?
it's got to be one of the things you have to do, is you've got to take your life experience and turn it into comedy. And so if you as a comic are having similar life experiences to other comics,
yes.
Then you, but equally, if you go too far the other way,
yeah.
Then you're going out of your way to do bizarre things so that you can yeah. write jokes about
it. I think it was either March or April 2007 when I got punched out inside the Best Kebab House in Glasgow by a stranger. And although it was a relentlessly unpleasant experience, I remember waking up the next day thinking, I've got the centrepiece of this year. I've got the centrepiece of this year's Edinburgh show. It's going to fit perfectly into what I'm going to do with that in that bit of the show, and it really did. And it was the big story in my 2007 show was the one about me getting punched in a kebab shop in Glasgow. So you kind of have to look at real life like that. People want to hear about real life, and especially when it goes wrong. I also believe with a passion that you should treasure those moments where everything goes wrong, because they are way funnier.
Okay.
I mean, fundamentally, they are way funnier, and an audience warms to you much more.
I think it's very difficult to let go, just speaking personally, it's very difficult to let go of my natural instincts to solve problems. And yeah. you do need to do that, don't you? You need to not solve a problem. You need to let there be a problem.
So any opportunity for self-deprecation, I relish. Mm. I grab with both hands. It's tricky at the moment because the nature of my TV role on The Chase.
Weekdays, ITV.
Weekdays, ITV. The nature of that role is to be smug and superior.
Yes.
And I would like to talk about my experience of the show, but I'm also very aware that you don't want to veer into that smug and superior thing.
Mm.
So at the moment, the only material I have about the show is the things that people say, strangers say on Twitter about my neck.
Yeah.
And it's so brutal and it's so horrible that it's working really, really well as a comedic tool. It's the audience. The
Thank
audience,
God.
Yeah, well, it's the audience breathing a sigh of relief going, oh, great, he's not going to be a dick.
Yeah.
About the fact that he's now on telly.
Yeah.
He's actually still going to be relentlessly self-deprecating.
Are you finding lots of people... I mean, I've no idea of the watcher, the viewing figures of the... I was going to say watchership before I realised it wasn't the word. Have you any idea of the viewing figures of The Chase, and does that reflect in your audiences?
Do you know what? It's so hard to say. Sometimes you do a gig and half the room seems to know who you are, and sometimes you do a gig twice the size and nobody's got a clue who you are. I mean, the nature where when it's on 5 p.m. means that a large number of the working population will never have seen an episode in their life. But it's more when I mention it, I hear this. When I walk on stage, I get these very irritating mutterings and murmurings from people, and then when I mention it, there's something, the light bulb goes on in people's heads.
Yeah.
But I actually think it's helped. There's an instinct. It's helped in some of the sort of rougher, worse clubs, because it gives you a status.
Okay.
It gives you he's on telly.
Yeah.
That perhaps you don't have at some of the worst clubs, where they don't have any instinctive respect for you just because you're on stage as a stand-up.
Sure.
Oh, right, you're one of those twats on stage, but you've been on telly.
Yeah, good lad. Good lad.
I've noticed that gigs often improve... When I mention it, which I don't mention till much.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Very late in the set anyway.
Sure. The only thing I know about your writing process is that I'm sure someone told me this, possibly not you, that you don't write anything down for your stand-up set.
I don't write out routines. No, I never have done. I can't think of any time in my life where I've written that wasn't for the radio, that was just for stand-up, where I've actually written out a routine. Luckily, I'm blessed with a very good memory.
Yeah.
Although that doesn't mean that I haven't let jokes slip through my fingers before. There have been times where I suddenly went, oh, you were meant to say that.
Yes.
And you haven't said that for 3 weeks, and that's actually quite good. But I also think the irritation of forgetting something helps as a memory tool.
Helps you to remember it next time.
Yeah, helps.
Okay, that's interesting.
But I've got quite an organised brain, but it's quite, like an awful lot of people, it's quite attention deficit disorder.
Mm.
And I get very easily distracted, which is why I find it difficult to write at home.
Okay.
Because I find that after about 10 minutes, I'm going, oh, I could make a cup of soup or a cup of coffee or watch a bit of telly or go on Facebook, go on Twitter, do this, do that. I find the amount of distractions there are in that flat are enormous.
Mm.
Whereas you do a gig in Newton Abbot in Devon, you're not driving anyone back.
Mm-hmm.
You got, it's 4 hours to get home. That's, I find where I can, and there's nothing good on the radio at that time. That's when I find that I can really focus on ideas.
So talk me through that kind of process. Like, if you say one way of writing jokes is to have an idea, write down all the different things about that joke, you know, do a spider diagram or whatever that process is. What's your basic process? Do you have a starting point?
I'll tell you what, it's not scientific.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing to say. And it just involves trying to crystallise what it is that you, what you think is possibly joke worthy in a situation.
So you have a sense to begin with. The reason you're thinking about a particular situation is because something in it appeals to you perhaps.
Let's take the story that you've heard many, many times of me being punched in the kebab shop in Glasgow. I look at that story and I work out where are the jokes to be had.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a pullback and reveal at the end, which I like to think I do in quite a subtle way.
Mm-hmm.
And once I thought of that, I thought, that's nice, because you're doing it in a really subtle way.
Which is the saying you were wearing the T-shirt of the opposite, the football shirt.
Yeah. And it's a nice pullback and reveal. And then I realise that actually the story is so dramatic that it doesn't need that much in the way of embellishment. And, and you try and work out how many punchlines... I try and work out in my head how many punchlines I would need to make this a valid routine. I don't like there to be... What I don't like is there to be too much of a gap between the start of a story and a punchline.
Yes.
Because it puts too much pressure on the punchline.
I agree. I've not thought of that.
It puts too much pressure on the punchline. I've always had one or two routines where the punchline is a fair way away from the start of the setup.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's asking a lot of an audience... If the punchline is too far away,
and it's asking a lot of yourself in a chopsy room,
to
keep them held together,
absolutely. And so you try and punctuate it with little asides, and sometimes I think those asides come to you when you're on stage. I'm sure lots of people had that thing where they've actually improvised. They've got a joke they really like that actually started off being improvised.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on stage and they suddenly thought, oh, I could say this,
mm-hmm.
For instance. And then it's, say with the story being punched at the kebab shop, it's working out which bits of the details you want to use and where the joke can come in.
Mm-hmm.
Where the joke should come in. And then what I do is I drive usually with the radio, with the radio off.
Okay.
Because that, otherwise I don't want to be distracted.
You've got to have nothing else going on.
I don't want to be distracted. And things sort of crystallise and come to me.
Mm-hmm. So what...
I never write it down.
That's incredible.
I never get the iPhone out and go, England shirt.
And you don't along the way, I mean, you don't make a note of anything. I mean, in the first four conversations that I've had, the only... common ground is that everyone keeps some sort of a notebook or a diary or a list of, oh, this thing happened to go back to. And I mean,
no.
are you doing that
now,
mentally?
I'm not necessarily saying that's the right thing. I'm saying that's the what I do.
No, I completely.
It may well be that I should instill more discipline so I don't let jokes fall through my fingers. It's just that I have quite a disorganised writing style, which is extraordinary.
or conversely, the most organised writing style I've ever heard of. But you're holding it in your head.
Yeah, well, the irony is, of course, that's the opposite of what comes across on stage.
Mm-hmm.
What comes across on stage is that every word has been, because it's so scripted what I do, certainly at Edinburgh level, it's so scripted what I do, that the impression is often got that every word has been pored over meticulously.
Mm.
Well, actually, the truth is, I think I'm just quite good at language.
Mm.
And so And so it doesn't take me that long to articulate what I want, to choose the word. It doesn't take me that long, I don't think, to choose the words I'd like the particular concept to be articulated.
Yeah. I think you might have sort of accidentally hit upon a brilliant solution to one of the key problems that a lot of other people face, which is trying to fill a blank page. You're never trying to fill a blank page.
No, no.
You're only ever having a thought, and then things are building on that thought around it. Whereas I can, like, I made a decision to stop using my laptop a while ago. I said, right, that's it, I'm no more writing on my laptop, because what I'm doing is, it's just so easy to keep writing blah, 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 and think to yourself, hey, yeah, I'm making stuff, and of this it'll you know, it'll distill down.
Yeah.
And then often it doesn't distill down because you've just been filling in time and it's blah. And so what I've been trying to do is have a pad and a pen and not write anything down until I'm convinced that that thought I'm having is worth being written down. And yeah, like, you're doing a kind of a sort of an elite level of doing that, whereby you're not writing down anything, but only the only stuff you remember is going to be the stuff that has, yeah, some value to it.
Now, it ought to be said that that it's been a long time since I've written a routine that was purely for the clubs.
Yeah.
What's happened is that I've done an Edinburgh show every year for the last 3 years, and then those routines that are considered strong enough to last in clubs have made it into the club set.
Yes. Okay.
But it's been a long time now since I've written a routine whose primary purpose was to be told in a comedy club on a Friday or Saturday night. So I think writing for Edinburgh and writing for an Edinburgh show is quite an artistic process. And I do love the fact, in fact, I have to say, blowing smoke up your ass, I really like the structure of the two Edinburgh shows of yours that I've seen.
Thank you.
I really like the way that it was shaped. I really like the way there was plenty of it. That wasn't robust enough, really. But I say that as a compliment.
Sure,
what it means
sure,
is that
sure.
The audience, it needs the audience to emotionally involve with you and go on a journey with you, which they don't necessarily do in 20 minutes in a club.
Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah.
I mean, I've got stuff that worked blindingly well at Edinburgh that wouldn't necessarily work in a club because there isn't that audience investment in who you are and who you are and what you are.
I mean, I've found there's some bits that I never felt really worked properly in last year's Edinburgh show that now, unencumbered from having to
do a job around.
Of structure,
yeah,
I just kind of throw them out. And there's a bit from the middle that I'm now closing on in clubs because it, you know, freed from all of the,
yes,
the requirements I'd put on it. It's actually like sort of it's working a lot better.
But what I would say is with an Edinburgh show, again, not written down, but I've always had to have a clear idea of what the narrative structure, I want the narrative structure to be.
Yeah, yeah. And well, I would suggest as well that because you're not writing it down, you can't fool yourself about whether it's clear or not.
Yeah, true.
Do you know what I mean? That's it. And again, almost like from the leap from making stuff for Edinburgh that then comes into a club set is, you know which bits. You're making instinctive choices the whole time rather than cluttering up.
Yeah,
rather than interrupting those instinctive choices by trying to impose a system on them.
Sure, no, totally understood. And there will, and when I write an Edinburgh show, there will be moments when I write things down, but they're only headings. They're not actual jokes. They're headings. So just that I can try and, or just so that I can make sure that I'm not doing things in the wrong order.
Yeah.
And also, if I didn't before each preview somewhere write down some headings, then I wouldn't necessarily remember whether I'd forgotten anything afterwards.
Yes.
Whether I'd forgotten to.
Yes,
I
would. Yeah, yeah.
But I don't bring paper onto the stage.
No.
Because I want to.
No, that's murder. That's like driving looking at the speed limit.
Don't get me wrong. I understand it. It's just never been me. I'd rather mumble and fumble my way through things than have a sheet of paper going, what next?
Sure.
Different strengths for different folks. But I find writing one-hour Edinburgh shows the most artistically exciting of all the writing things. And although I play all the clubs, I consider myself an Edinburgh specialist.
Yeah,
That's essentially.
Yeah, and I think that's possibly because I think I totally agree with that, and I think that's probably in part because, as I was saying before, you can write stuff that has meaning, that inherently has meaning, that is about something. Your quality control is really excellent. You don't do jokes about stuff that isn't worth doing jokes about.
No.
Really? Yeah, you don't mean either. It's something sort of casual and non-significant, insignificant, but there's a really good joke about it, or it's a good point about something, like a really good point that's worth saying that's also funny.
But the big five shows that I've done, I'm not counting the Love Actually show that I did in 2004, but the big five shows that I've done have essentially all been about me.
Uh-huh.
That's the thing. They've all been about me. It was just coming at it from a very different angle, using personal anecdotes to make points. But they're all stuff that only I could have done. I mean, I still maintain that is what every comedian should aspire.
Yes.
That's what every comedian should aspire to do. Even the political comedians. They should bring a sense of the personal. I'm not going to name names. I refuse to name names. But there are comedians that I see on stage whose joke writing ability is unquestionably there, but there's no connection made with the audience, because it's always about the jokes are always about other people, other things, other issues.
Yes.
And it's never about... There's no personal input into the jokes.
Yes, something I've...
So what you get is a craftsman, and you can see it's a craftsman, mm-hmm. but you don't know them anymore at the end of the gig. And I think every comedian should aspire to be on stage doing jokes that only they can tell. Somebody like Tim Vine or Milton Jones, they're one-liner guys. They still do that.
Mm-hmm.
They do jokes.
Yes, Milton Jones one-liner is unquestionably a Milton Jones one-liner.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And Tim Vine's performance sells the jokes.
Mm.
I mean, everyone goes that Tim Vine writes funny jokes. I think that's the greatest trick that he's ever played, because a load of his jokes aren't very good at all. Well, they're not.
I think that's very incisive. Absolutely,
what makes them funny is how he delivers them.
Yes,
it's the manner in which he delivers them, and the little asides, and this, that, and the other.
Yeah,
I speak as someone who couldn't be more of a Tim Vine fan.
Mm.
I think he's hysterically funny, but he's not a joke craftsman the way Milton Jones is.
No,
it's the whole performance, and that's what I love about Tim Vine. I really do. He just cracks me up completely.
That's the thing. I mean, one of the old kind of cliches of comedy. I don't know if it is a cliche yet, but it's kind of a respected structure within comedy writers, within the industry, is that you can be a man saying funny things, or a funny man saying things, or a funny man saying funny things.
Yeah.
And I think certainly Tim Vine, some of his things, as you say, they're not that funny, but he is a funny man.
Yeah.
And that's it. It kind of tumbles out like that.
But if you know the jokes in and of, that's why I find it irritating when they have these joke of the festival things and it
best
and,
joke
and actually, and I'll say this, it drives me nuts, because it's the very opposite as far as I'm concerned of what comedy should be about. A joke should be funny because there's a context and a man and an audience and a mic and a story that's been followed, and that moment in time on stage where a guy says that particular thing, the audience are laughing because it's that moment in time in that show, and that man saying that thing. You strip all of that away, take the words and put it on a page. It's not. It's
far. Yeah, the real title of that article should be "The Joke That's Best at Being Stripped Out and Put on a Page."
Absolutely.
And even then, they're often not.
No,
out of context, you'd be looking at it going, "Why on earth is this funny?" If you look at Nick Helms' one from last year about
the
password that was 8 characters long. So I used Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. That joke is hysterical when he says it on stage, because when he says it on stage, he knows it's a terrible joke. The audience know it's a terrible joke. Then he plays a music sting and starts moonwalking about what a terrible joke it is. That's why that's funny.
Absolutely. And it actually just drives me nuts. And I think of all the jokes that have really made me wet myself, very few of them could be reproduced on the printed page.
Mm.
And that's what. And I just find it I genuinely find it insulting to what we do, that they think that this is a way of assessing what you think of.
Yes,
how meticulous you pour over your every word in every show.
Yeah, like if star-based reviews are a pain in the arse, then it's almost like getting a review out of 1,000.
Yes,
you know, this Paul Sinner is a 895 comic.
Yeah, yeah, and I did well out of that Scooby-Doo joke. Even though the Scooby-Doo and Danish cartoon joke in 2006, I did well out of that. Even though they misquoted and made it sound that I thought Scrappy-Doo was his cousin, when I know perfectly well that Scrappy-Doo was his nephew, and I did well out of it. But nonetheless, it's not what comedy's about. comedy is about that moment on stage where you're having an experience with the audience, and that's why something is that is why something is funny. I think you saw the show. You saw the show that ended with me in a confrontation with a drunk lady at the toilets at London Bridge Station, when we were both queuing for the toilets.
I think so.
Yeah, that story works because for 55 minutes, the audience have been following everything that I say.
Yes.
And that story worked every single night, even there wasn't even a clear joke or punchline. Nevertheless, the story worked because the audience had followed everything up to that point. Yeah. And so they were laughing hysterically at the denouement of the story.
Yeah. There's so much. What always fascinates me and excites me is that there's so much in comedy from trying to make a one-liner that's a perfect joke that can be replicated somewhere else. That's an ideal of mine, and also an ideal of mine is completely the opposite, to tell a joke that no one else...
Yes,
can tell, and it wouldn't make any sense. If you look at Mickey Flanagan, if you write down Mickey Flanagan's stuff, there's no jokes in it.
No, absolutely. He's one of the best examples you could possibly have. Yeah. It is Mickey. What you're getting is a product, Mickey Flanagan, and it's a brilliant and hilarious product. But the things that he says are funny because they're in his mouth.
Yes.
In the same way, in a similar way to what sitcoms, a lot of great lines in sitcoms aren't funny jokes.
No, that's a good point. Yeah.
If people go the 10 best lines from Only Fools and Horses, well, they'll struggle to get about 4, because stripped out of context, they weren't great lines.
Yeah,
you know, Trigger going Dave. That's that's not on the surface a great line. So no, I do. I mean, the main point I'm trying to make is that I do think people, that's what people should aspire to be, doing stuff that no one else. Trying to do stuff that no one else can do because it's personal to them.
That's lovely. I'm really aware that I need to keep being quiet when I'd rather be saying yes.
Oh, right. No,
just
no,
for
no.
editing purposes.
No, understood.
That's a moment that I could go, sting. Great, lovely.
And that's why I kind of often stick to race and sexuality when it comes to politics stuff.
Yeah.
I think people who've known me for a long time will probably realise that race is not a big issue in my life, and never really has been. And actually, in the last Edinburgh show, I talked a lot about how actually class and privilege has been a much bigger issue in my life. The fact that I've got wealthy parents, and the fact that they sent me to the nicest school in the area, and all of this. But at least, regardless of whether race has been a big issue in my life or not, I'm always coming from a position of truth.
Yeah,
I don't like comedians. Again, naming no names.
You're going to have to do all the names afterwards in a list.
His comedy set suggests that every other day they're being racially abused or being racially put down or racially patronised, because I think we all know that's not a realistic assessment of how British society works.
Mm.
And it takes away the surprise value if every other joke is along those lines. But I think that's the other thing, is to try and be... I like to think... I mean, obviously, what you're presenting is a filtered version of yourself. And the audience, I think, are intelligent enough to realise that as well.
Mm.
They know that what you're giving is not no-holds-barred. It's almost impossible to give a no-holds-barred. We've all got things that we've done in our life that perhaps we're too ashamed of.
Those are my starting points.
to bring to the comedy table. I think it should be a true reflection of where you are. If I spent my time on stage going on about racism all the time... Then that is just not an accurate reflection of who I am as a human being. If I went on about homophobia all the time, it's not a reflection of who I am. But that doesn't mean I can't mock those people who feel that way. But I won't make out as though it's been a bane in my life, because it hasn't. I don't consider myself a victim in life at all.
Mm.
I consider myself a privileged middle-class public school boy who got lucky.
You're a very serious, methodical, sort of a person? You know, obviously you're a GP, you've done all, you know, you spent a long time studying.
I didn't know anything about anything to do with humour until I was about 11 or 12. And our English teacher read us an excerpt from an Alan Corran book, which was some sort of compendium of funny things he'd written for Punch. Mm. And I had not realised until that time that the written word could be as funny as that. And I remember when I was about 13 trying to write a funny thing, and I can't even remember what it was about, but it got printed in the school magazine. And that was the first time that I realised I could be funny. It hadn't occurred to me before. And I was the kid that used to write puns, jokes, put words to music at school.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we had a particularly fat class, and I remember rewriting the lyrics to Paul Hardcastle's 19 as a parody about the average weight of our class being 19 stone. That's the sort of thing that I would do.
Okay. Was that well received?
Yeah. Then at medical school, it was a bit more heightened than that, because I was involved in the review, medical school reviews, and also I was the co-editor of our gossip mag for a year, which was a nasty, salacious piece of work, but full of great jokes.
Okay.
And so I got heavily involved in comedy writing at medical school, but not much in the way of performing. I can't act. I really can't act. And I don't have great vocal range, and I was never really much of a performer. But the great thing about stand-up is you don't need to be. and that was the first time, really, I was aware of the British live comedy scene. When I was at medical school, we used to go to the Banana Comedy Club all the time and watch great comics and whatnot.
And who inspired you around then? Who did
Harry Hill, the obvious answer. Mm. And it's not because he was a fellow alumnus of St George's Hospital Medical School. It was because he was just so original and brilliant. And it was presenting comedy in a way that I'd just never seen it being presented, with these piecemeal snippets of songs and puns and this a lot of the time the punchline was 20 minutes. The 20 minutes after the setup.
I remember being in the car as a kid and hearing him do stuff about Pity the Almond on the radio, and it just blew my mind.
Saw him live on stage in a room full of about 60 to 80 people, and it was like, this is just amazing. But again, I never thought I could do it, and I never even fantasized about doing it. But I failed in 1994. I failed my medical finals and had to resit them in November, and I just needed something to do. So me and my sister used to go to a lot of comedy. You've met my sister, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
Me and my sister used to go to a lot of comedy clubs on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, try out night days, just to watch stand-up, because we both really, really loved stand-up. And it was only through watching a lot of try-out nights that I realised that I would be doing myself a disservice if I didn't give it one go.
Okay.
I'd written enough jokes over the last 6 years that I could call my own.
Sure.
In various formats. And so in June 1995, I did my first ever gig in Run by Har Bloody Har.
Okay.
In a pub in Acton. And I was on about fifth or sixth in the bill. It was a new act competition, but there was no prize. I think they promised progression, but I'm not sure whether that they actually were good on
it's their, a well-worn tactic.
I don't know if they were good on their word. And I'd practice in front of a mirror again and again and again.
Oh, one of them. Okay.
Yeah, practice in front of a mirror again and again and again, basically discreet one-liners. For 5 minutes. There was no narrative, there was no story, there was no nothing, just a bunch of discreet one-liners. And for the first 2 minutes or so, I got absolutely nothing. And I remember thinking, well, this was fun.
Yeah, I'm glad I tried.
I'm glad I tried. And I don't know whether anyone's the same, but I was terrified. The hour and a half before I got to the gig, I was walking around a park with a fake microphone in my hand, rehearsing again and again and again and again.
I do always put my hand there when I'm practicing a thing in my room.
and there's a huge difference between medical review and real life.
Mm.
And jokes that immature, relatively immature students find funny, and jokes the general public find funny, quite clearly a different thing, because I was getting nothing for 2 minutes, but somehow I pulled it round in the next 3 minutes, so that I'd probably give myself a 6 out of 10, where it was going to be a 1 or a 2 out of 10.
I've heard you do that before. I've heard you mark your gigs.
They're mostly tens these days. That's just the way it is. It gets a bit boring marking them after a while. But and there was just enough in it for me to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
There was enough adrenaline coursing through my veins, and at least two or three of the jokes actually getting a response. And then the next two gigs meant that I kept at it. It was the second gig. The second gig was in the King's Head Theatre in Islington, and I rang them up that week. And you know, you'd read your time out, you'd go and look at any bill where you didn't recognise any of the names.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd go, right, I'll give them a ring. And I rang up the King's Head Theatre in Islington on a Wednesday, and they said, we've got a space for you this Saturday. And I thought, oh, right, okay. All right, I'll do it. And there was three open spots, break, headliner, plus a compere. And two of the open spots died on their hole, and I did brilliantly, you know, amazingly.
Mm.
Which is bizarre. I mean, the standards were clearly so low. That was my second ever gig, and I'm storming a theatre.
Yeah.
what on earth is going on there? But what's notable about the gig was that the closing act was Ed Byrne, and the compere was Simon Pegg.
Oh, really?
So I gigged with Simon Pegg and Ed Byrne in my second ever gig.
Good guy.
And then my third ever gig was the Cosmic Comedy Club tryout night, Tuesday night competition, and I came second ahead of Jeannie Yashere. And those two gigs in quick succession were the two that gave me the impetus to keep going.
And enough of a lodestone to get you through the tougher ones, yeah.
To get me through the next 3 or 4 years.
Where... 3 or 4 gigs, I think.
No, 3 or 4, you know, knowing what it could be like if you got it right.
Yes.
And for about 3 or 4 years, I did open spots, and it was always like, good, bad, great, bad, bad, great, good. There was always just enough good and great to make you forget the bad ones. But I didn't really know what I was doing. I had no ambitions in it whatsoever. It was just, I was quite like the fact that I was a full-time hospital doctor who had this secret...
Yeah, secret other life.
Secret other life. I quite liked the thrill of that. But this discussion that you're having now about the scientific process of joke writing could not have been had back then.
No.
I didn't really know what I was doing. It's just that I had a good instinct for writing. I had a good instinct for writing a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that instinct kind of just got me through it without me ever really thinking about joining the jokes together or... In fact, the first time I ever really joined the jokes together was perhaps the routine that served me best in my career, which is the one about the taxi rank in Manchester. The thrill of doing that routine for the first time, when there were like 3 or 4 punchlines in one thing.
Yes.
Before, it only just been joke, 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 here's another topic, and so on and so on. And the jokes nearly had nothing to do with each other. And that was the first time I was trying to tell a story, and I liked it. But that was 2005, so 10 years.
Yeah,
10 years after I started doing comedy was the first time I ever actually tried to tell a story.
Do you feel, just talking about, like, you remember saying about that feeling of, you know, you got punched and a little part of you is thinking, this is going to be good stuff.
Yeah.
Is there? Do you ever feel like the opposite of that? Do you ever think, unless something happens, I'm going to run out of funny?
Yeah, you
do. Okay. Yeah. I like asking this question. No.
I think that all the time, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why I'm not doing Edinburgh this year, is because I don't think I've got a new story to tell.
Okay.
I am writing a one-hour show this year, but it's not for Edinburgh.
Okay.
I'm writing for the Sheffield Comedy Festival and possibly to do in London in August as well. But I think it might be more for people who've never seen... It might be a show for people who perhaps who's never seen me before and only perhaps only know me from The Chase. Mm-hmm. I want to know the backstory.
Okay. You've got quite a lot of backstory. Yeah. I was thinking, if you've got to put together a new show based on your best of your old bits,
well, that's
going to be an easy write, isn't it?
No, it's not going to be a best of, far from it, but... I don't feel, despite the fact that I'm now on telly, I don't think enough has happened in the last 12 months for me to come to Edinburgh with a new show.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that the following year that maybe won't be the case, and I will have plenty.
And are you someone that ever has kind of long dark nights of the soul? How do you deal with the... It seems from what you're saying that comedy to you is something that came along, you had a good job and a good life, and then comedy came along and that's really fun too, and... You know,
dark nights of the soul, yes, but yeah, definitely, but not specifically about comedy.
Okay,
I'd like to think that we all have dark nights of the soul.
Christ, yes, yeah.
I would hate to think that I was alone in that. No, dark nights of the soul.
Well, you can never tell from the outside. Is kind of my point. You can look at some comics and maybe they perform. I'm so alone. I'm so bewildered or frightened by the world or confused about emotions or something like this. It's, some people play that, some people don't play that. But, I mean, I would like to think that that everyone has moments of going, what the hell am I doing with my life?
Oh, absolutely. But I also think that life is a real adventure and you need to, you know... I feel that there doesn't have to be any rhyme nor reason to what you do in life, that life is an adventure. People... Well, confused by the fact that I say, "Oh, I'm never going to be a doctor again." I've severed that side. They go, "Well, how do you know what the future's going to hold?" To which I go, "Who cares? We'll get to that. We'll get to that when we come to it." I think I've got enough going on that if the stand-up didn't work out, there'll be other avenues I could go down. I mean, I'm lucky in that sense with the television thing, meaning that. The status has gone up a little bit, and hopefully it will stay there for a while. But I just think life is about new challenges and adventures. It's not for everybody, of course. For everybody, some people for whom stability and a clearly defined future. But that's not why we went into comedy, is it? For a clearly defined future.
No, just as well.
Yeah. We went into it because it is an adventure. I think when you're not enjoying it at all, then have a dark night of the soul. But if you're doing a job that you enjoy, that puts you in such a small minority of people in this country. Most people work to make ends meet. Work because you enjoy doing the work is a very privileged thing. But it's complicated, really. But I feel at the moment that I've not made all the best decisions in life as regards my comedy career. That I think I've worked too hard over the last 4 or 5 years. I think that I've said yes to everything. I've said yes to all gigs, and suddenly I'm wondering why there are mates of mine that I haven't seen for six, eight, 10 months. And when I say mates, I mean good mates. And so I think
that those things are the things I am perpetually having long dark nights of the soul about.
Yeah.
So I think maybe you're not thinking about them for a while was an excellent tactic.
I mean, I've got a godson I haven't seen since August last year. I've got lots of friends I don't see. That, and I think these aren't insoluble problems. Far from it. I just think that we have to be more proactive and less lazy. People have to be more proactive and less lazy about dealing with the problems and just accepting from time to time to say no to work. I think that's the key issue. You can't just it's like any job. You can't just keep working non-stop.
No one's going to offer you less work, are they? No one's going to.
Well,
the buck stops with you, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
In terms of turning down stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But no one's forcing you to do anything. But in terms of Long Dark Nights, the source, where the career is going, nah. I always think that most things are out of your hands. I think the purists would like to say that hard work and talent will always see through, but I don't necessarily think that's true. And you need huge dollops of luck, and the degree to which you get huge dollops of luck in your career are usually well way out of your hands.
Yeah.
And so I just think all you can do is try and keep getting better, and that's it.
Thanks very much, Paul Sinner. Cheers for your time.
That was a pleasure.
Thanks very much for listening, team. Appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed yourselves. I think Paul had some really fascinating stuff to say there. He's a constant inspiration to me. And one of the things I love is how matter-of-fact he is. He seems to have a very well-ordered mind, which I think is... that's something that must be very useful when you're in this job, and I wish I could replicate that myself. As always, any questions or feedback or information to info@comedianscomedian.com. Have a look at the website, which is www.comedianscomedian.com, naturally. And there's also a link on there now that you can buy tickets for both my Edinburgh show, Prick, and also the Edinburgh live version of this show, The Comedians Comedian Live. So go to the website, follow the links, get your tickets, and get all excited about that. I'm jumping on a coach now. I'm going to go and interview Sarah Millican. Hopefully that'll be out within the month. Speak to you soon. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.